The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. Today's show is built around Ada Lovelace Day. And if you haven't heard of Ada Lovelace Day, or Ada Lovelace, well, that's why we're doing the show. Ada Lovelace is regarded as the world's first computer programmer. Augusta Ada King, Countess of Lovelace, was born on the 10th of December, 1815, the only child of Lord Byron and his wife Annabella. Born Augusta Ada Byron, she wrote the world's first computer programs for the analytical engine, a general-purpose machine that Charles Babbage had invented. And Ada Lovelace Day, March 24th, is an international day of blogging to celebrate the achievements of women in technology and science. And while most of us involved in this show don't blog, we do have a radio program. You can visit findingada.com for more information about Ada Lovelace and all the blogging that's happening in her honor all over the world. In recognition of the day, we have some amazing women on the show. Our feature interview is with Sharon Birch McCrane, author of Nobel Prize Women in Science, Their Lives, Struggles, and Momentous Discoveries. But we'll start with speaking up. We're here today with Heidi Anderson, a development coordinator for a victim services agency in Spartanburg, South Carolina. She's the mother of two incredibly smart sons and the wife of one incredibly patient man. She started out with her website, fatoneinthemiddle.com, where she wrote on skepticism, parenting, sexuality, and body image, and is now launching shethought.com. Welcome to the show, Heidi.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the site.
Well, shethought.com, we are going to launch on March the 24th, which is Ada Lovelace Day, which you very graciously told me about. I was originally going to launch on Pi Day, but due to personal issues, I needed to kind of push it back some. Mm-hmm. So you helped me find another great date, and it is going to be a site for women interested in skepticism, science, and rational thought. Just another venue out there for women who are interested. Women can write about it. It will be about women who are scientists or active in the skeptic community, or some women don't even use the word skeptic. Some people just use the word rationalist, and that would be fine as well. So I am now accepting essays from a whole bunch of different people and very excited about it.
So you used the term critical thinking, and you just mentioned that people don't necessarily use the term skeptic. Is there a difference to you between critical thinking and skepticism?
The difference to me is that there seems to be, skeptic now has an identity as a subculture. And I don't know that people would consider critical thinking as having that. But I feel like with the word skeptic, that sometimes we lose people who basically agree with all of that, but they don't want to peg themselves into a subculture. I think of my husband. My husband would never in a million years call himself a skeptic just because of his association with, oh, that's the subculture, y'all do this, y'all have the amazing meeting, all this kind of stuff. But he is one of the people who has been a mentor to me in learning critical thinking. He was an engineer in college, was in science classes all throughout high school, and I was much more liberal arts based. And so he has kind of helped guide me to where I am now, but he doesn't necessarily feel the need to hang out with other people who are thinking similar to how he does. And I realize that not everybody has that need for an attachment. Some people just want to have their opinions, have their beliefs, have their way of thinking, and try and spread that, but not necessarily all of us get together and go drinking. Like, right. We skeptics tend to love to drink, right?
So why a blog on critical thinking, specifically for women?
To me, it seemed that so many of the blogs and so many of the most prolific of the writers and activists in the atheist, skeptical communities, critical thinking communities, they're men. And for me as a wife and a mother, my first thought was of course they have time. It takes a lot of time to sit and, you know, put a podcast together, as I'm sure you know. And for a lot of the people who were doing that, they were either single men or they were men that had wives. Now, I'm not going to assume that their wives were taking care of everything else, which gave them this huge amount of free time, but that's historically been the way it's worked. So I felt like a lot of those were really trying to bring women in, but they didn't exactly know that we're not going to have the time to get into flame wars, maybe, like right. They do. Maybe we don't want that. Maybe we want a place where we can go and discuss things and not devolve into people calling each other trolls and running away and, you know, getting into their big fights. And not all of the sites are like that. But I know that when I've commented on a few sites before, things just got really mean really fast. And this is a group of people that is very snarky. And I love that because I'm equally snarky. But I also realized there's a lot of us that aren't so snarky. And those people sometimes are getting their messages getting left behind. So we need to have a place where women specifically is what I was looking at can go and can talk about skepticism, science, critical thinking, rational thought, maybe even atheism. Let's not get into that, though.
That's a whole different show.
That's a whole different show. But they can get into that, and we can have a place where maybe there's just a little bit different of an atmosphere. Because there can't be too many ways for us to approach this. So I just wanted to come in with a little bit different of a way.
So this is more about inclusivity to you.
Yes, it is. Very much so to me. I think sometimes within any subculture, there becomes an in-group. And this is a subculture that is still pretty small. So it's kind of easy to get into that in-group. But that doesn't mean people outside of that in-group don't feel excluded. And I've never met someone in the skeptical movement who has made me feel like I wasn't welcome. But I'm also not a shy person. And I'm pretty much going to go in with guns blazing wherever I go. And I realized that not everybody feels that way. Right. And so I wanted a place where maybe it's not just your big names in skepticism. You know, maybe it's not just the people that everybody knows. I want to give a chance for people who maybe they're doing their first essay and they want a place where they can do it. And women who may say, oh, you know, my grammar's not perfect. Will you please look at this? You know, I'm not a professional blogger, you know, that kind of thing. And they want to submit something and they want to get involved, but they don't want to take the time to start their own blog because that's a huge deal. So here's a place where they can come. Maybe they do one essay, maybe they do two, and they don't have to make this huge commitment of keeping it going. I'll take that piece on. And this is not going to be a blog that is my opinions. I still have plenty of outlets for my opinions. Facebook and Twitter and Fat One in the Middle are still all about me and what I think. So this is really not going to be another pulpit for me to preach from.
So, of course, there are going to be the inevitable comparisons between skeptchick.org, the other women-centric skeptical blog. So what would you say that the difference is between She Thought and Skeptchick?
I would say the first one for me is that right away, there is not a set group of bloggers, that there is not going to be a She Thought crew as to these women are going to be posting on a regular basis and only these women are going to be posting. I don't want there to be a brand. That's not what I'm looking for. I want a venue that people can go to and explore this level of thinking without having to get into that. I think it works for them and I think it's wonderful. I love the skeptics, but it's about them and their opinions. And actually some of my favorite posts that they have been doing recently, they have been also highlighting and spotlighting lots of other women in the skeptic community. And it's just absolutely wonderful. And so I want a place where people who are not, you know, the names of skepticism, and most of the women in Skeptic, you know, they are those names, that they can come and they can have a place where they can talk and they can have an audience. I am not shy, and I have no problem pimping myself out to whoever to get attention for other people, you know, and myself if that need be. But but I want people who are they're so humble sometimes. Like, you know, I adore Swoopy. I adore Robin McCarthy. And I want her to have a place, or me, if she's not going to talk about something that she's doing, I want to have a place where I can go and say, hey, everybody who's interested in this, go check this out that Swoopy just did. You know, go check that she's going to this concert and they're going to, you know, interview this person for Skepticality. And sometimes she may not be as willing to do that. And that's something that I'm good at. I can try and reach lots and lots of audiences.
So are there going to be any boundaries on who can write?
As long as people are focused on the theme of women in skepticism, critical thinking, rationality, science, no, I don't even have a problem if men are writing, as long as it sticks to that theme. And it will depend. I want to keep my ability. I'm not going to just post everything that people send me. If somebody writes the equivalent of the Christopher Hitchens article on women are not funny, and says that women are not smart, that's going to be hard for me to post.
Right.
Although it would probably, in that kind of situation, probably be better to post it than just, you know, give that person's personal email out with it.
I see where this is going.
Right. And just let people take care of it that way. But I'm not looking for people who necessarily agree with me. And because I am so vocal, you know, within 5 minutes of meeting me, you know my views on everything. So people pretty much know where I stand on everything. And I want people who don't necessarily agree with me, feel free to post. I want to talk about it. I want to have the discussions that sometimes I feel like we're not having in the skeptic movement, that we're not talking about, like different methods of outreach within skepticism, what works, what doesn't work. Do we need to focus on women in skepticism and critical thinking? Is the very fact that we're doing a website on this, is that helpful? Or do people think that's hurtful to continue to bring up the fact that it's still mainly white men? Some people would say we need to just get over that and stop talking about it. And I agree in some ways, but my way is that we need to create our own venues is what we need to do. And so that's one of the things I'm trying to do.
Well, let's talk about one of those topics. You are somewhat of an activist, somewhat, I'm saying, this is my understatement of the year, within the pro-sex, pro-porn community. And there's an ongoing debate over whether using sexiness to sell skepticism is productive or detrimental. So how will the blog deal with those issues?
I want people to be able to come to She Thought and discuss those issues, but discuss those issues in a way that doesn't get into people's personal sexualities. I talk a lot about my own personal sexuality, but this is a place where I actually want to look at the bigger picture. Because when I'm talking about important issues, like when I go out and do speaking on sexual assault or domestic violence, I don't bring my personal sexuality into that talk. And when I have done presentations on skepticism and parenting, I don't bring my personal sexuality into that, because what that then does is it takes the focus off the issue and puts the focus on me. And I want to make sure that people understand that when you bring sex into an arena, it still changes things. And when I bring it, I know that someone may view me and my ability to discuss my sex life with anyone, that may make somebody think, oh, that's great, that's wonderful. I mean, I get told that a lot. But that doesn't necessarily mean that other women are prudes just because they don't want to talk about their sex lives.
So who's your target audience with She Thought then? Is it the same audience as you would want to write for She Thought?
Pretty much, but I also would like people to... When I think of the skeptics, I think of a very fun, young, smart, and I'm going to use this word and it sounds, I know, so ridiculous, but hip group of women. I think of that. They're fabulous. They're funny. They're really snarky. There are people, though, who don't want that, who are not looking for the necessarily the funnier, younger aspect of it. And we can have that as well, because I'm not going to tell people to change their personality, but I also want something that I feel like is being underrepresented with women in skepticism, which may be women who don't want to, or, you know, maybe it's through no fault of their own, they couldn't be hip if they tried. You know, they don't know how to do snark because they're just too polite and they're too nice. And, you know, that's kind of a generational thing as well. But some people just don't like snark. They don't like sarcasm. They don't want any of that. And if we only approach it through that, we might be losing some people. I don't think that this is going to be a direct competitor to Skeptic, because I don't see that there's a need for competition any more than you have the Center for Inquiry fighting it out with JREF. I guess anymore. Since they've all come to the table together, right? But it's not going to be like that. It's more that here is just another way for people to get their thoughts out. Here is another way for people to talk about these issues. But I do want to make sure that women who aren't comfortable getting into their own personal sexuality feel comfortable talking about whatever issues. I don't necessarily want people in the comments flirting and that. It's just more of a distraction for what I'm seeking to do. I'll be more than happy to talk with them directly, but not in this realm, right? And it's possible. I have many different facets, and I am able to maintain that level of thought for more than 10 minutes at a time. So
how can people contact you if they want to write?
Well, it depends on what they want to talk to me about. obviously, there is my blog, fatoneinthemiddle.com, and that blog is all about me. That is basically the Heidi show. And it is sometimes not safe for work, but it's funny. You know, whatever's not safe for work is usually not what I've done. It's stuff I found on the internet that's funny. So don't go there, click on something, and then get mad at me. I'm just showing it to you. And there's also, obviously, She Thought. So they can write to me at skeptheheidi@gmail.com.
And this launches on March 24th?
March the 24th.
And can you tell us the first blog post, or are we all supposed to just wait?
Oh, you're supposed to wait, because I have yet to pick. I'm getting posts, and I'm very excited about it. And I don't think I want it to be me. I think I want to start off letting people know that this is not another outlet for me to talk. So I think I want to pick something that someone else has done.
Heidi, thanks very much for being here today. I am seriously looking forward to the blog.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be right back after this.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, either through the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still hear the broadcast live on our ustream.tv feed, which you can find by clicking the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to those stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LPFM 99.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia, CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, CJAI, Amherst Island Public Radio, 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario, CLHI, Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia, Freethought Radio, and WPRR, Public Reality Radio 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I have one announcement before we get to our interview. Skeptic.com has launched a new series of banners, Faces of Skepticism. They'd like to help you get to know some prominent and some grassroots skeptics. Dr. Harriet Hall of ScienceBasedMedicine.com, Robin Swoopy McCarthy of the podcast Skepticality, George Schraub, skeptical entertainer and host of the Geologic Podcast, Sharon Hill, who writes the blog Doubtful, me, who does this, and fellow skeptical Edmontonian Marion Kilgore, who writes for SkepticNorth.com. Now, that's five female skeptical activists out of a total of six, and it has nothing to do with Ada Lovelace Day. That's just apparently how Skeptic.com rolls. So congrats and thank you, Junior Skeptic Editor Daniel Loxton. The series was his idea. So check out Skeptic.com to see the series, and just keep refreshing your page until all six pop up. So we're on the line today with Sharon Birch McGrain. Sharon is a former newspaper writer and physics editor for the Encyclopedia Britannica. She's the author of Nobel Prize Women in Science and Prometheans in the Lab, Chemistry and the Making of the Modern World. She's currently at work completing Bayes' Rule, a history of Bayesian probability.
Yeah, that's right. That's
I have
good.
A problem with that word, Sharon. And she lives in Seattle, Washington. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So the Nobel Committee, just to give people some background, they give out three science prizes every year in physics, chemistry, and medicine.
Correct. Medicine, biology.
Right.
Physiology, they call it, but that's the life sciences.
So since the prizes were first awarded in 1901, how many women have won in the science categories?
16 prizes have gone to 15 women. That's because Marie Curie, of course, won two prizes. But that's only 3% of them have gone to women. But the good news is that three women won science Nobels this year.
Brilliant.
That's never happened before. It's never been anything like that. I was hoping that with the centennial of the Nobel Prize in 2001, I kind of thought it would be rather splashy if they had two and possibly three women, but of course they didn't. So they waited until now, and there might be some reasons for that.
Well, how many prizes have been awarded in these categories total?
537.
Oh, so okay.
3%. I got up my calculator.
Oh, okay, well, let's talk about the most famous and the first time the Nobel Prize was awarded to a woman.
Marie Curie.
Mm-hmm. So that was the prize for physics in 1903.
Yes, and then she wins the one in chemistry in 1911.
Okay, so what did she win her first one for?
It was set up from the very beginning. She had just explained that with radioactivity that it emerges from inside the atom, and that shattered the view of the atom that it everyone had thought it was solid and inert. And immediately science began studying the atom. She started all of that. But she'd also discovered in the process of that radium, and that was the first possible cure for cancer. So it was, how do you say, she was called the Vestal Virgin of radium and
right.
regarded as quite saintly for this contribution. So in the very beginning, the chemist said, okay, physicist, you can give her the prize now for radioactivity, but we're going to do radium in chemistry later.
Now, so, why did they decide that? What was the situation around this?
The prize itself in 1903 in science was not well known. The literature and the peace prizes were exciting, and they got press and so on. But the science prizes were considered by the tabloid newspapers that were just coming up and so on. They were considered too esoteric for the general public, so they hadn't gotten much attention. But when Marie Curie, this beautiful woman who discovered this thrilling cure for cancer in a shed in Paris. That was so exciting. She made the Nobel Prize. She was our first star scientist before Einstein.
You mentioned the shed. Can you talk a bit about sort of the circumstances surrounding being a scientist at that point, and specifically being a female scientist?
Well, she had come from Poland. If you can see a map in front of you, from Germany through Poland, through Central Europe, through the Russian Empire, all the way to the Pacific Ocean, women could not go to a university. So she lived in Poland, the part that was controlled by Russia. There was no chance of her or her sister going to a university. So when they scraped together the money, they went to Paris, where you could go to the University of Paris would admit women. So she wound up there. She meets Pierre Curie, and they fall madly in love, and they work together. Neither one of them has any money. He finally gets a comfortable salary, but his working conditions are very, very poor. France is not, had been the center of world science for a long time, but Germany had overtaken it. And there was this romantic notion of the lonely scientist working against all odds and poverty and all this kind of thing. And that's what they fell into this trap. They had no place to do their experiments except the shed outside of the university where Pierre worked, where Pierre was a professor. And that's where she was. That was all part of the Marie Curie legend.
And at this point, not only were scientists not paid very well, Marie and Pierre were part of sort of the movement to not patent their research.
Yes, that was an idea, a very idealistic idea that they were working for humanity. And this was held not just by them, but by many at the time, that they were working for humanity, for the betterment of society, and that they should not benefit by it personally. Later, she realizes that someone is going to benefit by her discovery, and she might as well do it and have a research laboratory.
Right.
And that's a big switch for her.
Now, initially, she wasn't even nominated for the 1903 prize. Her husband was.
Pierre was, he and his father were both very idealistic dreamers with the ideals of the French Revolution. And both believed in women's rights and women's education. Now, Pierre didn't care about prizes for himself at all, but he cared very much that Marie would get credit for her work. So he gets a letter, kind of an underground letter, from a scientist on the Nobel Prize Committee who says, you are being considered for a Nobel Prize. Now, Pierre realized what he was really being told was the prize is not being considered for Marie. It was actually for radioactivity. That was her work, her contribution. It wasn't his. So he writes back, and he says it in a very charming way, I think. He said, if it's true that one is seriously considering me for the prize, if it's true, I very much wish to be considered together with Madame Curie with respect to our research on radioactive bodies. But that was her work. And then he says, don't you think it would be more artistically satisfying if we were to be associated in this matter?
Nice spin.
And, of course, that's what made the prize, the science prize. Mm-hmm. From then on, the press paid attention to them every year.
So how was her win received?
How do you mean the public? Was
the public. Now, is that different than when she won the prize in 1911?
Well, in the meantime, Pierre dies. He has been carrying a little vial of radioactive material in his pocket and taking it out with his bare fingers to show friends. He just likes to handle it. He keeps it right next to him all the time. And he becomes more and more sick with radiation sickness. And eventually stumbles in the street and is run over and dies. And after a while, Marie Curie has a relationship, unknown kind of relationship, mm-hmm. with another physicist who is married, unhappily married, old friends. And they rent a little apartment together and they have lunch together. And neighbors testify in his wife's divorce trial, which names Marie Curie, that they behave like lovers. Well, we don't know. Times were so different. Marie Curie's granddaughter is also a physicist. And she said, you know, times were so different. We don't know if they were, you know, if it was romantic. Maybe they were just studying together. But she said, I hope it was an affair. But the press, the right-wing press, grabs on this and makes a terrible scandal. There are rioters outside of Marie's home. She's inside with her older daughter, and they're throwing rocks and yelling at the street. The right-wing press considers her, because she's Polish, she's a foreigner, she's stealing a French woman's husband, and it becomes, she collapses afterwards and goes to a sanitarium for quite a while under an assumed name. It's quite awful. She's the first media star in science, and no one knew that something like this could happen. In the midst of this, she gets the second Nobel Prize, goes to Sweden, collects it, comes back and collapses.
Because
pulls herself together again, of course.
Well, at that point, now she had radiation poisoning as well.
Yes, she did. But she taught, she'd get away a couple of times a week all through that period, because she taught in a girls' school, right, like a high school.
And she
would get out of Paris, and she was a fanatic about fitness and being outside and gymnastics and swimming and hiking and so on. And she liked to go outside and breathe deeply of the fresh air. She kept her radium sample by her bedside. She didn't keep it in her pocket. And she was a superbly healthy person. So she did not ever get as sick as Pierre did until the end of her life.
Well, this is the thing. No one was researching the health effects of radium at this point.
Well, there were, toward the end, her daughter also works with radioactivity and wins the Nobel Prize. And she also has health problems. And there were some people in the laboratory who became ill and actually died. So after a while, they must have known. But to acknowledge that your discovery is harming people, that she couldn't do.
But what she did do is inspire generations of female scientists, including her daughter. And her daughter wanted.
Well, there's part of it that she also saved the lives of probably thousands of French soldiers during the First World War, because she sets up, the French military has the idea that if someone is injured in the war, they must be taken back to a really first class hospital in one of the cities. And of course that transport takes time. And she realized that they needed some emergency treatment right away as close to the battlefield as possible. So she organizes the X-ray units that treat thousands upon thousands of French soldiers during the First World War. And her daughter indubitably got the radiation problems from doing that. All through that, she was sending radium samples off to hospitals all around the world for cancer patients.
If you have a question about Marie Curie or the Nobel Prize-winning research of women scientists, email questions to live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet Skeptical Radio. So, Sharon, we're not just talking today about women who have won the Nobel Prize in Science, but also women whose research have enabled others to win, and
yeah,
who, in all likelihood, may have won, if not for their gender. So I would love to hear about Emmy Noether.
Oh, she's something, isn't she?
She's fascinating.
When I wrote Nobel Prize Women in Science, there was quite a serious depression on, or recession. And the press in the United States was filled with why the U.S. science and technology is dead. We can't compete with particularly the Japanese at the time. And so I thought if I could look at some women scientists and find out why there weren't more women scientists to fill that gap. That was a puzzle I had in my head. And I chose the Nobel Prize to look at women who had either won it or had contributed in a very important way to someone that inevitably a man won. because I wanted a nice number of them, but also because I was told that the public, U.S. public, didn't know that women had really done any significant science. So I thought if I took women who had been touched by the Nobel Prize, which is so revered, that they would give me at least that this group of women had done important science, and then we could look and see what had happened to them.
Right.
So that's why I added Emmy Noether, because she is considered one of the 20th century's most important science mathematicians. There's no prize for mathematics in the Nobel Prize system. So she wouldn't have gotten it for her mathematics. But she was a founder of abstract algebra, and she had a Noether theorem that helped lay the foundation for quantum theory, and her ideas are very important in the computer science industry. So it was hard to write about scientists and not to write about one of the century's greatest mathematicians. She's also an example, I think we can see, of what possibilities there were for a woman before the Second World War at the very top of world science. Mm-hmm. Germany at the time, until the Nazis took over, Second World War, where that was the peak of world science. And if we can understand a bit what happened to Emmy Noether, we can understand a lot about what realistically a woman in science could expect. She was exuberant, buoyant personality, gentle, earthy. She described she didn't like her doctoral thesis, and she described it in some words that I would expect that would not be permitted to be used over the Canadian radio. But her career, her life, was delayed for years by a whole series of legal obstacles that the German government had set up to prevent women from getting the college preparatory education and then from getting into universities and working in them. And she would get through one obstacle and then wait for the next obstacle to be broken through, and then she'd slither around it or through it. I think of her as academic subterfuge. Her father was a mathematics professor in a German university. Until the 1920s in Germany, a woman could not really, it was very difficult to get the math and the language, Greek and Latin, that were required for entry to university. So she went through the normal schooling for girls, which ended at 13 or 14. And then she went to get, so that she could earn her living, she went to school to learn languages, which she was really quite poor at. After she gets that teaching degree, all of a sudden she becomes kind of rebellious because she doesn't teach languages. She then decides to audit mathematics class. At that point, it had just become possible for a woman to ask a professor in a university to attend his lectures. Before, you had to write a letter to the German Ministry of Education. So there was a liberalization, and she skittled right through it. She audited classes. Eventually, it became possible to take classes in a university. She gets a degree. Her father had had polio as a child, and as his health declines over 10 years, she takes over his professorship. She teaches his classes. She takes care of his graduate students. She goes to international conferences. It's all illegal, of course, but she does it. Eventually, she had become, thanks to this horrible thesis that she wrote, she had become an expert in invariant theory. And one of the great mathematicians, David Hilbert, asks her to come to the University of Göttingen to help Albert Einstein do the mathematics for his general theory of relativity. And Einstein becomes an enormous fan of Emmy Noether and interferes in her life throughout her life to help her and even her family when they get into trouble. When she gets to the University of Göttingen, where Einstein is working, there was a law against women lecturing in most German universities, so she had to lecture anonymously. She was not allowed into the scientific society that published papers, so someone else had to submit her articles for publication. She She was the editor of the main, most important mathematics journal, but her name never appeared on its masthead. That's why I call it sort of academic subterfuge. She eventually, thanks to Einstein, gets, and thanks to the fact that the German Empire collapses after the First World War and a more liberal Weimar Republic takes over, she gets an unpaid position with a lovely title. She becomes an unofficial extraordinary professor. And by the 1930s, she is the head of the leading school of mathematics at the leading center of mathematics in Germany. Einstein has interfered a number of times during this. He writes in 1918, for example, on receiving the new work from Fräulein Nutter, I again find it a great injustice that she cannot lecture officially. I would very much be in favor of taking energetic steps in the education, in the Ministry of Education. If you don't think this is possible, I'll do it by myself. Unfortunately, I have to leave for a month, but I ask that you give me a short note when I get back. If something has to be done beforehand, you can do it over my signature. Then later he writes again about Miss Nutter. He says, yesterday I received from Miss Nutter a very interesting paper on invariant forms. It amazed me that one could view these things from such a general standpoint. It wouldn't have done the old guard at Göttingen University any harm had they picked up a thing or two from her. She certainly knows what she's doing.
Now, this woman is getting references from Einstein while at the same...
And David Hilbert.
Exactly. And by the time of her death, she hadn't had a permanent position, had she?
No. In 1933, when Hitler takes over, she is among the very first university professors to be fired. She's a woman. Well, mostly it was because she was a Jew and a very liberal. She was a pacifist, and that was too much for him.
Right.
So she gets fired. She's recognized as with David Hilbert, the two most important German mathematicians who have to be rescued. And her colleagues are found really quite plum jobs at various places. And the best that can be found for her is a temporary position in a very fine women's college, Bryn Mawr. But it was only for undergraduates. It had no graduate or postgraduate students, and of course not with the level she worked at. But she said she was the happiest there and the most appreciated in her whole life, and it was the only time she ever earned a salary.
That is ridiculously painful.
And that was life at the top, Desiree.
Now, this woman had edited a mathematics journal.
She's one of the editors. You know, they have
right.
a whole bunch.
For years.
Board, I guess.
But she wasn't on the masthead.
No. Now, when she died, the journal did run an obituary for her, which at the time was it was illegal under Nazi law.
Actually, Einstein wrote something after her death as well.
Yes. He writes the letter to the New York Times about that she has died.
Yeah. I actually have that here.
Good.
Because I thought it was brilliant. Fräulein Nutter was the most significant creative mathematical genius thus far produced since the higher education of women began. In the realm of algebra, in which the most gifted mathematicians have been busy for centuries, she discovered methods which have proved of enormous importance in the development of the present-day younger generation of mathematics. So even after her death, Einstein is still trying to, force people, encourage people to recognize her?
Oh, absolutely. Well, he's a very great practical help. Her brother is an applied mathematician and of course, also is of Jewish background and in Germany. And when she comes to the U.S., he finds a job and goes with his family to Siberia. And he is arrested. And a month before the Germans take over Moscow, he is executed. And Einstein and one of his colleagues rescue his two sons, Emmy Nutter's nephew, and bring them to the United States and get them education. So the man was, he really worked where he believed.
Right. We actually have a chat room question.
Good.
I
hope I'll be able to answer it.
This is from K.O. He asks, Marie and Irene Curie both had the support of husbands who were also scientists, while Emmy Noether didn't. Did that difference play a part in keeping her from winning the prize, considering she contributed a lot of work to the physics of the day?
Well, most of the women I wrote about had husbands who were very supportive. I don't think so. I think it was more the fact that there was no mathematics prize.
Let me just elaborate on that question. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, sure. Because it wasn't only that they were supportive, they brought a certain amount of credibility to their partners. Would that have helped?
You're thinking of Pierre Curie?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, the second
the
one,
Corys,
she won
actually.
All by herself. He was dead.
This is true. But the initial time, and Gertie Corey as well, had a husband that was very well known.
Yes. The situation in the United States was very different, but it was also very difficult. In the U.S., women could get an education early on, but they couldn't get jobs. And it involved what we think of today, this very intimate issue of marriage and whether you have children. And I think that's maybe what this gentleman was getting at. They were caught in these women were caught in a catch-22, really, because if they stayed single, they could teach science in a woman's college or at a very low-level position in a coeducational university. But the teaching loads in both cases were very heavy, and there was little opportunity for research. So if they wanted to do research, remember that most of the heavy research institutions in the United States were all male until about 1980, we're talking about. Caltech, Princeton, Yale, Harvard, all of those. If you wanted to do research as a woman scientist, you were better off marrying a research scientist
right.
in the same field and then working free or at a very low salary in his laboratory. And there were dozens of these couples, especially in biology, all over the United States. And they did that well into the 1980s.
How many women do you think actually got married solely so they would have access
to
a lab?
Well, they didn't have to actually get married. They could form sort of a professional marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people who worked together unmarried as professional partners, collaborators for decades. The mechanism for this process, if we want to answer the public's question of why aren't there more women scientists, we really have to understand this. Starting in the 1920s, there were state laws and university regulations that forbade universities from hiring the relatives of university employees. There were lots of exceptions made for the male relatives, like
right.
brothers and uncles, sons. But there were very few made for wives. There was a national laboratory in Washington that wanted to hire a Dutch couple, and they had to get an act of Congress passed to be able to hire the wife, to get around these nepotism laws. Now, today we would simply say we hire the best people we can find, and we make sure that relatives don't supervise relatives. But at the time, in effect, they forbade hiring married women scientists.
Right.
They needed access to the laboratory. They couldn't work. A novelist can write in a kitchen, a historian can write in a library, but a scientist needed access to a laboratory, and these laws were enormously devastating, and they lasted from the 1920s until 1972. When there was a woman in Congress was going to pass the Equal Employment Opportunity Act, and she insisted that they include universities in that because they were getting federal funds. And at that point, and at that point only, these laws and regulations, every place I've ever been able to find the date when those nepotism laws were rewritten and they could hire married women scientists, it was 72, 73 when that law went into effect. Most women scientists were married to other scientists. And that's the generation that would now be winning Nobel Prizes. They were dramatically affected by this legal discrimination.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by Miriam Goldstein, doctoral student at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Miriam has been studying the Great Pacific Garbage Patch up close. She'll join us to clean up some common misconceptions from the mainstream media and even popular skeptical sources. And on Speaking Up, science blogger Greg Fish turns a critical eye towards the fantastic predictions of transhumanist futurists. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, live on CJSR and at skepticallyspeaking.com.
On Skeptically Speaking, we discuss a wide range of skeptical and science topics with a variety of experts. But I'd like to remind you that you, yes, you personally, are invited to join us on air every week for Speaking Up. Because let's face it, outreach is a part of skepticism. We all do it, whether we're talking to our parents about why they shouldn't buy into that multi-level marketing scheme, explaining the misinformation around vaccines to our coworkers, or forwarding that Snopes entry on why typing in your PIN number backward on the ATM machine does not, in fact, summon the police. But if you want to take your skeptical activism one step further and reach a broader audience, we're here for you. Do you have an event coming up that you'd like to promote? Or maybe you're a blogger that's been doing some great work and you'd like to talk about it? Or you'd just like to get some experience speaking publicly on a science or skeptical topic? What better way to get some real-world practice than on a friendly, rational radio show? If you're ready to have your say, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put Speaking Up in the subject line, tell us a bit about what you'd like to discuss, and we'll contact you to set up your very own 10 to 15 minutes of on-air goodness. We're looking forward to hearing from you. Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We are here with Sharon Birch McGrain, author of the fantastic book, Nobel Prize Women in Science. We have about 5 minutes left in the episode. I think we've made it to 1935 around there.
Well, let's have an example really quickly of the effect of these laws. Gertie Corey. She and her husband explain how the body uses energy, the metabolism cycle. And all the enzymes that do it. She's the laboratory genius of the pair. She trained 6 more Nobel Prize winners in her lab, and she and her husband share a Nobel Prize. It's almost the first prize she's ever shared with him. Even after she gets the Nobel Prize, he gets prizes by himself. She didn't become a professor until the year she won her Nobel Prize. She was an assistant, legally. And she earned 1/5 of his pay, 20% of his pay. She opened up the entire field of genetic diseases when she discovered on her own, after her husband was doing administration, a whole series of children's diseases that were caused by missing or defective enzymes. She's incredible. She's just absolutely fabulous.
Now, in the book, you wrote actually about a grant application to the Rockefeller Foundation.
Yes, she wrote a grant application. She was asked to write it. And she writes about the Coreys are doing this, and they will do that, and Coreys this, and they that. And when you go to the Rockefeller Foundation archives, you see that someone there crossed out they and Coreys and wrote in Carl Corey, he, Carl Corey, he, and just wiped her out of the grant application.
So
she would have been livid. Totally livid.
Well, would they not have received the funding if it was they and we?
Oh, no. The university, they went to, Carl had to give up a lot of job opportunities because he insisted that they include Gertie. And they finally wound up at Washington University in St. Louis because that was a very liberal institution as far as women are concerned. So this 1/5 of his pay, they were totally thrilled by it. That's how bad things were. I think maybe, though, we should conclude with, I don't want to sound like such a downer. The women I wrote about succeeded because they were passionately in love with science. They couldn't imagine living without it. They just had a wonderful time doing it. When I signed books for people, I used to say, I hope that you enjoy your life's work as much as these women did theirs. maybe to get a glimpse of why Gertie Corey would have put up with that, we should read what she said.
Please do.
About the beauty of doing science. Is that appropriate?
Absolutely.
She develops a terrible disease and keeps working for 10 years until she's so weak that her husband carries her from room to room in her laboratory. When she dies, there's a memorial service, and in it they broadcast a record that she had made for a television program. And in it, she talks about why she loves science and truth and humanity. She says, "Honesty, which stands mostly for intellectual integrity, courage, and kindness, are still the virtues I admire, though with advancing years, the emphasis has been slightly shifted, and kindness now seems more important to me than in my youth. The love for and dedication to one's work seems to me to be the basis for happiness. For a research worker, unforgotten moments of his life are those rare ones, which come after years of plodding work, when the veil over nature's secret seems suddenly to lift, and when what was dark and chaotic appears in a clear and beautiful light pattern."
Sharon, you know, what comes through in this book is just how passionate you were about these women.
Well, I was very curious about what had happened to them. When I started writing about them, I didn't know these patterns of discrimination. People really didn't know. It was one of the first books, and most of them were still alive, and their colleagues, and their students, and their family members. I interviewed hundreds of people, so it's filled with fabulous stories about fabulous people. It was a high writing it.
It was brilliant to read. And,
well, thank you.
Definitely.
We have to thank the women. It wasn't me. It was those women.
And we are absolutely out of time today. So, Sharon, so good to have you with us.
Well, thank you.
People, I did not even scratch the surface of the book. I think that we may have made it three chapters in. So Sharon's website is McGrane.com, and there's a link to it from our website. When you're on her website, you can find this book and all her other books, which I plan to order promptly. So,
thank you.
Absolutely. You can find us at skepticallyspeaking.com with links to our Facebook fan page, to us on Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. Hello again, everyone. One last thing we wanted to mention. Next week is Skeptically Speaking's 1-year anniversary. Yes, we've provided you with 52 episodes of Skeptical Radio, bringing you everyone from Adam Savage, Phil Plait, and Eugenie Scott, to episodes on subjects like paranormal investigations, neuroeconomics, and evolution. So after 52 episodes, we think maybe we've known you long enough to ask you for a favor. If you support what we're doing and you appreciate the fact that we're attempting to spread the rational word on the only syndicated science and skepticism radio show around, please consider heading to iTunes and leaving your review. It only takes a moment, and it helps potential new listeners decide if we're worth checking out. It also helps new radio stations decide if they should rebroadcast our show. And if you happen to live in an area that doesn't broadcast our show, and you happen to be acquainted with a radio station program director, perhaps, maybe send them a link to your favorite episode. But if you aren't tight with your local radio station, you could also join our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. We very much appreciate that as well. So that's all we want for our birthday. And in return, we promise to make this year even better. Thanks, as always, for your support, everyone. It makes every crazy week worthwhile.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of some have love spells, cause we're skeptically speaking. Our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.